Welcome to The Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter at securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
So I watched Leave the World Behind, I think it was 2 weeks ago or a week and a half ago.
You were watching it.
And I know since then, when I had a little get together here with a buddy that was visiting from Japan and his family and a few other friends. And, you know, after a few beers, people are talking and cyber comes up and I'm like, oh, have any of you guys watched Leave the World Behind? And my buddy's wife goes, oh, I got 20 minutes in and I just couldn't watch it anymore. And I was like, why? What happened? She's like, that type of stuff just freaks me out. Like, is this really what the world's coming to? Like, maybe it is, but I just don't want to know about it. And then my other buddy's wife was like, well, I feel like I missed a good portion of it. I started watching like in the middle and I kept asking, you know, my husband, what is this? What did you turn on? And she was watching because like it had some pretty well-known actors in it, but was trying to understand the premise of what's going on. Is this a sci-fi movie, right? And since watching it, I've looked at some people's chats, read a few things. We've talked about what we thought was reality, what could be real, what is complete movie make-believe. But then, in essence, outside of the cyber side of it, the whole idea of leaving the world behind, right? Like, at what point have we already left a certain part of the world behind? The whole idea of nurture and nature and dependencies on, you know, I used to joke when I was working at a cyber software company that basically we sold air, right? It's like, yeah, just upload this code into your computer. I'm going to sell you that. That's a product, right? It's bits and bytes, right? Like, at what point have we left the world behind because of this digital age we live in? And then at what point, you know, in the way the movie was shaped, is it like, now we're leaving? Is there a point where then one day we leave that world behind? And then what do we go back to?
Right. Let's, I think there's a couple of, if we take a step back from the movie itself, without getting into the individual components of it and what actually took place, you know, I think that there's two philosophical things that are very interesting. Number one being what confusion and chaos can do in society. And just talking about when you have, and we've seen this politically, right? When you start getting all of these polarizing views and people stop banding together for a universal cause anymore, and kind of the destruction of the social fabric that brings us all together, right? And I think we saw a component of that in the movie itself. But the other interesting thing for me is you talk about kind of moving on from the digital era, and you start to think a bit from a individual skill set perspective. If something like that was to ever happen, right? So if you look at probably our age group and older, that we span both sides of the spectrum, right? Digital era was still coming. You see posts all the time that talks about, I think it's pointed more towards millennials being the last generation that know actually how to use find a book in the library using, you know, the card system, versus something being online, that a lot of those traditional skills are lost on future generations. Why? Because I've got it right here and it's got to be right here. And then if all of a sudden I can't use my phone anymore and the internet doesn't exist, where do I go? What do I do? That becomes interesting. Not to go all doomsday, because I don't think the chances are super high that anything like that could happen. Dan can now hear us again. But it's interesting. Oh,
Well, I look at this, was that 2 days ago, 3 days ago? I was with Kelly at a Christmas party over in Canada. And as some of the people started arriving, people were talking about the route they took to get there, the wait at the tunnel. And the one gentleman was like, "Oh man, as soon as I got in, I got completely lost, had to pull over." And they're like, "What happened?" He's like, "Oh, I have my phone set. Didn't have it set to data. So when I lost signal," he's like, "my maps went down. So I had no clue where I was going." He goes, "So I had to pull over and, spend 5 minutes." And it was like, I know that feeling of like something doesn't work. It's always worked. Now it doesn't. And that 5 minutes is the most painful thing, right? But back in the day, it was like you pulled over and we're like, "Honey, pull up the trip tech real quick," right? It's like, "Where are we?" Right.
My
I'm pretty
librarian
sure.
wife continues. We have paper maps still in the car.
I was going to say, I'm pretty sure my kid
Always will.
still prints off MapQuest, which I didn't know MapQuest still existed, but yes, they are still a thing. So.
And you know what? And I won't tell her this unless if she listens, which she doesn't, but she might if she ever listens. You were right, honey. Paper maps, they've helped. I won't admit
But
that in life, but I can admit it here.
the interesting thing is, right? So you take a movie and kind of juxtapose it with kind of real life activity and what we're going on. We don't have to go too far in going over to what's happening in Ukraine, right? Look at the Ukraine itself and certain surrounding countries where all of a sudden internet goes out. It happened to, what was it? Satellites, right? That were handling a lot of the communication for military, and it stops a lot of what you're doing. I mean, it's the underpinning now of everything that we know.
Well, it happened even here. Come back to Ann Arbor last year. There was a 4-day power outage. DTE and Ann Arbor don't always have the best relationship, and it was a multi-day thing. Here's the thing: most of the city's internet services require battery or power backup in order to work, and the battery backups didn't go that long. So the house was without internet. The lights stopped working. All of these things have these built-in requirements to be communicating. So we've done this to ourselves by having everything ping back, and then they freak out when they can't get back to their main
Right.
server.
Well, to pick on Ann Arbor too. I mean, if you look at what happened to University of Michigan with the breach not too long ago, right? Being in class, all of a sudden we lost access to all of our materials and oh, but we don't have paper books. We don't have things that we could rely on. Now, granted, a lot of what we do, they're Kindle versions, so those were still operable, but anything that was reading that was sitting in Canvas, no access.
As long as you all know the words to go blue, then you're fine. You can just do that for 3 days while you
I
wait for the
mean
power to come back.
the victims.
Yes. As far as I agree, there's only 2 words.
And if anyone's going to question because they're watching the video and sees my hands, my daughter got a what do you call it set? It's a nail set, salon set. And for the last 5 days, I've been a member of the salon every 2 days, and you get a free service, which she updates the nails every day. So if you're questioning the colored nails as I bring my hands up, that's it. But
It's NAS, nails as a service.
yeah, what Brian did just didn't want to admit. He was actually the first one to play with the set, and that was after the kids had all gone to bed. It's like, wow, this is really interesting.
This is really cool, and I'm good at this. So we've seen the upwells going back to the movie, and the big hits were a lot of the OT, IoT. Right. When you look at the boats, the planes, the cars, embedded software, right? In the last year, we've heard, well, I mean, it's even really front and center right now, where CISA's come out with a lot of information in terms of how there's chatter or information of how much China has tried to embed themselves in just tunneling deep into infrastructure. And there's you watch the movie, and that's the whole kind of premise is you tunnel deep enough, and let's say there is a war or somebody wants to create an act of aggression, if you can create pandemonium and chaos, and that's really without spoiler alert, giving away the movie, one of the characters and what his job is and his estimations from a finance standpoint, what he puts together, when he gets closer and closer to the end and he starts talking more and more about a certain person who works in the government that he works with, right? He's like, is this what's playing out, right? Like, is the cheapest way to create a war, or not create a war, to overtake someone, to create that chaos? So, and we saw it in the start of the Ukraine war, and the first thing Russia did, Dan, you mentioned it, trying to knock out connectivity, right? Then they went and were deploying wipers to try to wipe data going deep into infrastructure to create chaos, right? If you can create chaos in the country itself, it creates an even bigger problem from an infrastructure for the government to manage, let alone the command and control.
Right.
And we've seen the report, or I shouldn't say reports, we've seen the government in the last year talk more and more about critical infrastructure or critical business and supply chain. And part of that supply chain is making sure that the supply chain is protected. This isn't like automotive reference for those listening, going back to saying, did you do your PFMEA, DFMEA, and can you produce 1,000 parts per minute, you know, or per hour? This is, can the machines themselves, are you protected from a supply chain standpoint, from an ordering standpoint? Is your code protected? There's two levels of that supply chain. One is your software supply chain. And then the other one is then from a production standpoint, is your OT environment protected? And some of that gets lost in conversation when you talk with security salespeople who are like, yeah, no, I do supply chain, right? And it's like, you do code. There's another level of supply chain that's in manufacturing and is embedded security. And then there's the automotive rules that have come into place. And it's why one of the reasons why I wanted to kind of go back into automotive and embedded cyber, it's the new big thing in terms of the hot topic and requirements, that now there is going to be a requirement that you got to be able to track vulnerabilities backwards 15 years and forward 15 years in the vehicle, and then have a way to patch that, right? And that was something that they started to consider how to do that, but they were kind of like, well, let's wait to see what the rule actually is before we overinvest, right? Because at the end of the day, their business is making cars. So until they can find a way to create revenue streams off of selling services in the vehicle, which is a whole nother conversation in itself, the vehicle itself has more and more software. So for those watching the movie, there's a point where all these white vehicles, and yes, they're all white, are piled up on an expressway, and they realize, like, these are self-driving vehicles. Like, the vehicles are self-driving. Someone's taken over them. And one by one, more vehicles start crashing in. And it created complete chaos because you couldn't get in or out of the city because it was completely blocked with all these vehicles that had crashed into each other. So takeaway there. Can you take over the vehicle in thousands of them at once to create such pandemonium?
Yes.
I would agree with Dan on this one. And I don't think we have to go
There's
back
not much commentary to that.
We'll go back. How many years ago was that
Jeep.
The Jeep. Yes. I can't remember
almost 10 years probably.
So there is an element. Now, how feasible it is to take over a whole fleet of them, hard to say, right? But is it plausible? Sure.
It was actually coming up on it was Black Hat in 2015, so it's just, you know, just short of 10 years, but the world hasn't really changed. Yes, there's defenses, but I think the reality, the takeaway from this portion of this movie for me is that, just like anything that can be built can be undone and broken into. And the, you know, when building out security operations or building out security programs, one of the first things that I say to either board members or colleagues that aren't part of the information security world, and I harp on a regular basis, is that there's no such thing as perfect security. And somebody with enough will, interest, and intent will find their way in. And we build controls that will keep out 99, 98, 97%. But those high percents that want to get it, they're going to get it. And this is a reflection of that. Yeah, and I think designing for the 100% and waiting for the 100%, I think is what has gotten security professionals into a lot of trouble. This binary idea that if it's not perfect, it's not secure, it's not worth doing, rather than continuing to move things forward. This is where we're seeing, I think, a difference between the security world that I started in the mid-90s and the security world today.
Totally agree. I've got a similar saying that I use all the time. There's always somebody with more time, more money, and a higher technical skill set. If they want in, they're going to get in. Right. So our focus is on being able to pick up on that quicker, and everything's measured in seconds. And the quicker we can close that down and kick them out, that's how we're going to measure our security program.
And there will always be those that will that decide not to leave the house, not to pursue anything because the potential of the world around is just too scary, is just too, potentially dangerous. But at the same time, it's also a really amazing world out there, and there's great innovation and great things going on. And when this is when you stop thinking about it as security and start thinking about it as risk management, the balance between risk and value, risk and reward, then it becomes a lot clearer. If I make these decisions, if I have a car that drives for me, I'm making this comment anecdotally. This may be one of those things I don't necessarily believe in, but I'll say it anyway. If I have a car that drives for automatically for me, the benefits I get outweigh the risks. Now, personally, I love to actually drive, and I doubt I'll ever embrace a fully automatic, fully self-driving car, or at least the functionality of it. But that's the decision I'm going to make. It may be safer, but you know what? Or may eventually be safer. But right now, I enjoy driving, and I want to keep my hands on the wheel and keep moving it and drive it the way I want to. Because every time I turn it on, it's painful to watch this thing try and go. But that's a risk decision. So, all of these things, same with, to buy a car with those functions. You're talking also to somebody who would much rather have a car with just a manual transmission and not a damn computer in it. I like that level of control over my automobile. But what did I buy? One that's fully automatic and has all of the newest bells, whistles, and batteries in it. And that was a risk decision that I took. The benefit, the enjoyment, the ability to use it, the features that it brought, and the risks that it brings, all of that together. But if we stop thinking about it as binary security and thinking about it as variable risk along a continuum, it becomes a lot easier to make those decisions.
So one thing that I think the movie kind of put a magnifying glass on, but without talking about it, because it wasn't, the movie's not a technical movie, right? It's meant to invoke emotions, right? And a little bit of fear, or a lot of bit of fear. But we've seen vulnerability management become a huge conversation topic. A lot of new companies coming into it in the space of supporting vulnerability management in terms of offering up, whether it's services, some new product, some new blinky light that, and we've also seen a lot of researchers spend more time on it. You've seen CISA get involved, where there's a lot more information out there of actively exploited vulnerabilities being updated, which allows people to put scoring in place. But if we did the five why, nazi, and back up to when something bad happens, why? Well, this exploit. What was this exploit? Why was it created? Well, there was a piece of software put in for this function. Why was that function needed? And you back up, and I'm not saying that 100% of all bad actors or hackers are going after vulnerabilities, right? Versus just simply phishing somebody, right? There's a whole other level to that, which is an education piece. But when we get into that portion of it, I really think when you look at the, and then there's the whole scoring piece, which I really like because it literally is kind of tying back into the DFMEA, the design failure mode analysis of how you do your checks, low volume production, high volume production trials. And you're seeing more of that where if software code has to be slower in its deployment, because now you're saying, well, what's the criticality of this ECU within, say, a vehicle or in this boat or in this airplane, right? If it touches this function, the criticality is a 10. So in that case, we need to make sure that all of this is vetted. So now you have to have those processes in place, which vet that, right? And then prove it out. So until those industries then say that these are the rules that we adhere to and the supply chain has to adhere to it, and if they're doing those things and you're starting to see more of that, you're going to start to see more robust software and supply chain from a code standpoint built, which then means a supply chain where you're using equipment that has ECUs or embedded PLCs, et cetera, inside of it, become better and better because of the risk for that single part or that single function, right, that it applies to. So I think that's all important, but it's not something that you just flip a switch and it's like, we're going to do this tomorrow. And the software world has run for years on the, you know, we move fast and break things. People still joke that they move fast and break things. It's true. And that movie is kind of a big indictment of that, right? Like, can boats crash into a beach? Like, you got these random boats coming up onto the shore. Well, when we were sitting around here having beers and someone was like, that was so far-fetched. I'm like, well, it wasn't too long ago that, you know, a certain shipping company was completely stranded at sea because of watercraft, right? The boats had no idea, like, boom, everything was dead. There was no communication out. Navigation was gone. It was like, oh, wow, what do we do? I mean, you can still drive the boat.
I was going to say, I think that's a little different, right? Because that's, I lose communication with the boat that, all right, I'm just going to sit here until things come back up versus somebody remotely taking control. And that's where I think it's interesting, right? Because I think as we look at the consumer vehicle market, we start to see plausibility goes up there, right? Because of automation, the way the code is done, we know they're all remotely connected. But I think as you start to go and pivot and look at the commercial aviation, commercial shipping, I don't think you see that level of connected automation to automatically drive some of those fleets. There's still a mechanical closed system component to it. Now defer to somebody like a Chris Roberts that knows this, that field way better than I do. That's just my understanding. But I still think there's some insulation there, which for me kind of begs the question, just because we can create something in cars, should we?
Well, but yeah, and I think that's a, there's an important distinction, and you know, to bring it back into the movie, since that's where, you know, we're pivoting this all around. Excuse me. You know, the idea, I believe, well, first of all, the cars kept driving. If you notice, all of the mechanics kept working. So we weren't looking at EMPs. We weren't looking at things that were disabling electronics. We were looking at misinformation. The planes were not being steered from elsewhere. Most of those planes are not remotely controllable in that way. They were, however, getting bad data, which led to bad decisions. Bad, no GPS, bad, you know, bad elevation data, things like that, that would cause them.
I heard too.
What's that?
Christmas movie. I was like, Die Hard 2, Christmas movie.
When they changed the elevation, below, yes.
And planes are crashing.
Local mechanical components, right? If we look at the issues that, oh my gosh, what was the big airline company that got because of the
Southwest last Christmas?
Was it last Christmas? No, this is going further back.
Southwest last Christmas had an IT system that failed that prevented them from scheduling, moving, or at all of their airplane and crew logistics were offline. And yeah. Booking systems.
Wow, this is Boeing. No, I'm talking the actual manufacturer of planes, right? If you look at Boeing.
Ooh.
And
was that the 737 MAX?
The 737 MAX, exactly, yeah. That it was a mechanical component. It had nothing to do with remote controlling, but it was a single one that they knew could fail. They didn't put another one on the plane. So if it failed, good luck. But there was no real remote electronic component to it. It was a physical component that's part of the plane that's giving direct information to the plane in real time as they're flying.
Mm-hmm. And so then pilots were making bad decisions and creating the crashes. It's it's a very, so, you know, this comes, I think, full circle back around to the, you know, the information that we get and our reliance on it. I mean, not, and again, this whole episode is, we'll title the episode spoiler alert, but the, you know, the idea at the end that the daughter, and I think this is another whole parallel in this, is that the daughter in the movie was dying. She in the middle had been watching Friends on her iPad and streaming, and so without the physical media, she was not unable to watch the last episode. And so the level of panic, the level of ridiculous obsession to find out how it ends. That the her whole goal and driver during this crisis was not about other people. It was not about the state of the world. It was getting to a place that had a DVD on the shelf so she could watch the last freaking episode. there's a parallel in this in terms of how much media, the mechanisms we buy, it, the fact that you don't own it anymore. I mean, I love my DVD collection because there are movies that are tied up in lawsuits that aren't on streaming. And if not for my physical copies, I would be unable to watch them. And then you go into rights, streaming rights and things, shows from the 80s and 90s that when they get released were pivotal around music and local music of the time, but they weren't licensed for it. So when they come out on streaming, they have some horrible alternative that they inserted that ruins the stories. I'm a big fan of preservation of content and not messing with it just because of licensing, but at the same time, only using the things you're actually licensed to use. So, I mean, I'm on both sides of this. I'm looking at you, Microsoft and AI and OpenAI, as you scrape content from the internet without paying for it or licensing it. So all of this comes back together. There's a couple of different streams around it, but it's all focused around information, accuracy of information, availability of information. What happens to society when you cut that off? We become so hungry. We suck on that nipple so hard to get just a little bit more out of the bottle. And when it goes away, we cry just like a baby does.
Right.
Well, the Lions playing on the NFL Network, was that 2 weeks ago against Denver? And I was like, go to pull it up. I'm like, oh my God, I don't have the NFL Network because I don't have cable. And I'm like, I don't want to go sit at a bar by myself to watch this game. Right. I'm like, and there was this emotion inside of me of what do I go do? And it was so funny watching that little girl in the movie, all like she was heartbroken. Not that the world is coming crashing down. A boat just ran up onto your beach. Beach day is done. Even at the beach, she wanted to watch the rest of this show. And as it progressed, and then the sound amplification, right, that was being done. And it's like a warfare technique, right? And won't give away too much here, but it definitely impacted one of the people in the movie quite a bit. And the physical things that started to occur, and then the conversation they were having about how there were studies done using the amplification of sound and what it does to the brain, right? And that massive scale. And it was another mind-boggling technique.
And some of that, a lot of that's not new, right? That if we pick on the sound piece, if we talk about the varying types of pamphlets that were dropped by the drones to create confusion on who is really the actor, you could go back to much older wars where propaganda was dropped from planes, not too different. We could go back to what happened, not Ruby Ridge, but with Texas, with David Waco. Koresh, Waco. Yeah. And some of those techniques with the loud music, the sleep deprivations, that's not necessarily new. I think the movie just did a good job of starting to fuse together some of the older techniques, tried and true, with some of the cyber components and extrapolating. What would it look
That's
like?
That's the part there. Take away communication, your ability not to be able to watch the news, your ability not to be able to text, your ability not to be able to call someone. And now you get a pamphlet on this side of the country that says it's this country attacking you. Another state, another location, it's this country attacking you. Let's just say you five different versions of that same pamphlet. Because you can't verify it, right? You have no idea. You want to believe it's true because it was dropped and, I mean, it's freaking you out, right? Same with that other side. And then the government can't update the people because there's no system in place to do so,
right?
Besides the screen doing the you know, there is an attack occurring, right? That's all you know.
You take away the physical boundaries, though, how is that any different than what we've seen prop up in the digital space on social media, right? That you have stories that are amplified, whether true or false, nobody really cares. They're amplified. Why? Because they garnered eyeballs and hit different demographic group, different belief groups and stuff, and have created this mass divide between all of these different groups. That's not too far off from reality and what we're seeing today.
Very similar to what the CIA did when they went into Iran a long time ago to overthrow. And, you know, you got two bags of money. You go to the one group that's, you know, pro-communism, the one group that's pro-anti-communism. You tell them, hey, here's a bag of money. I just need you to go to the street at this time and have a rally, right? And then you go to the other group and you're like, I need you to show up 10 minutes after 3 o'clock and have a rally, knowing chaos is going to break out, right? And then you videotape it, make sure that all the media streams back home are pushing it. And this was before social
There weren't so
media.
much videotaping in the 1970s. Well,
Yeah,
there were, but not with the quite of distribution.
but there are these clips being shown in pictures of riots, and people feared what? Communism, right? It was like, oh my God, we got to do something, right? It's like, it reminds me of watching the video. You know, movies where it's like, give me my war, right? And it's like, you send somebody out and they do this, and boom, there's your war. Not too far-fetched from that same ideology. And then, you know, we were talking about it earlier, influence within, you know, leave the world behind, influence within our own government, or sorry, government, but influence in social media that impacts elections, which is government. And, you know, there's a lot of information out there that can tie one group to creating a pro-Islam or an anti-Islam group in Texas, right? And put together events for both groups in the same place, knowing that it would create chaos. And the people who owned those weren't even in this country, you know, those Facebook pages, but they got massive amounts of followers, right? I mean, that's in a sense. Let's go too political there, but like that is another way where, you know, you can sow discord, and there's several ways to go about it. And I think the movie, I mean, I could only imagine if something really crazy took place, the misunderstanding around the way all that technology is connected or used, and the dependencies that people have because they left the old world behind for the digital world, and now they can't get information readily, right? And I think there's also a lot of heartache too. Like if you know, your loved one was traveling and that took place, it was the same thing, you know, at 9/11, right? Trying to find out, like, oh, my family was flying on that day. Were they on that airplane? How can I get information fast enough? If all that communication is down, there's also that gut-wrenching part, right? So it plays into a lot of different emotions that people could feel. And I, you know, tying it back to leave the world behind, you know, leaving the world behind to go to a digital world. And then at some point, if you're pushed to leave that world behind, even for 5 minutes, right, what that impact is to you.
Yeah. I think that part of it was super accurate. That if you think about in the context of no information, the reversion that you would see people go back to into self-isolation and protectionism is I don't know what's going on, therefore I'm just going to focus on me, and you lose that camaraderie that binds everybody together.
Yeah, the I think some interesting trends, and the both of you think about the question I'm going to ask you when I'm done with this little bit here, is what from having watched this movie, what would you or do you plan to change about how you what you do, you buy, you implement, you deploy in your life, at work, whatever? What will you change as a result of this? What thoughts has it brought around that make you want to adjust? And in asking that, I forgot what my comment was going to be.
I thought the answer for all of us was just going to be to buy all the seasons of Friends on DVD.
Well, I have that already. the yeah,
So
I
it's
think
stay friends with Dan and make sure that Dan continues to build a library and make sure there's a route to Dan's house, whether it's a path through the woods, a tunnel.
So the comment I was going to make was, you know, as you look at how society has evolved to become dependent on some of these things, you know, I travel a lot, and the idea that when I started traveling, we barely had text, we barely had phone, you know, we had mobile phones, we didn't have texts, and it cost a lot, and they didn't always work across networks, across carriers, and definitely not across countries. And when I started traveling a lot overseas, you know, it wasn't quite as urgent that I report back to friends and family that I landed, that I, you know, that I've arrived. And even when I did, it was a single, hey, I'm here. And as that communication has become more direct, more available, the urgency that comes from not communicating in immediate fashion, you know, a plane is late, oh my gosh, what's wrong? You know, all of those kinds of things have created a little too much connection. And I'm not even, this is not social media. This is just, you know, hey, I landed, or I'm landing. I'm taxiing. I'm at the gate. I got off the gate. Just that level of hyper-connectedness has created this angst, this need for that fuel of information. When not, you worry that something's wrong. And then you start freaking out in your own head because you don't have that information. And as the one who's often the provider of that, I mean, the one sending it, I'm split between whether or not I continue to feed into that, because I think it sets up some bad behaviors of always needing to know where everybody is all the time. I used to grow, when I grew up in the summer, I'd leave in the morning, and the only rule was be home by sundown. Not where you're going to be, not who you're going to be with, not, you know, you took your bike out, you went to play at the park. What are you going to do at the park? Who are the people? Have they been background checked? Where are you going to be? Are you going to be playing baseball? Are you playing first base, second base? Did Timmy slide in? And all of this, you know, I really think have created the helicopter world that we live in. And as someone with a teenager, I'm very happy not to be in that world. I like to think that I didn't do much. I purposely tried to stay out of that world, but I think it's only getting worse. It's creating this world of angst when you don't continuously report. And it puts a lot of burden on the person who has to report. It puts a lot of burden on people always to be doing that and reporting rather than living their lives. That's the piece I take away from.
That's deep, and actually statistically backed up too, that we are arguably, excuse me, living in the safest time in history. Therefore, it doesn't warrant all of those, hey, Dan's hit all of his checkpoints today. All right, Dan, it's like playing a video game, tracking you through your progress.
Well, is it the safest because we have taken away every ounce of creativity, innovation, and ability for somebody to wander and explore and have an emergency and figure out how to fix it, or fail and figure out what it means to come out of a failure? Or are we actually...
We're leading us into a deep philosophical debate on societal change.
Yes, but again, this is what I think about when watching this movie, because again, this goes back to the wife and not knowing where the wife is and if she landed. And granted, there are things environmentally that make you more concerned that the flight might not have arrived. I get that. But this is where my head went, looking three or four or five steps beyond, in that we feed this beast. And social media feeds this beast. And all of these things feed this beast. And are we just creating this level of angst in ourselves, which then leads to, you know, I'm not going to go out. I'm not going to drive an automated car. I'm not going to all of these things, because we've lived now in a fear society because of the continuous updates.
I mean, we know that's happened. That if you go back to another show, go back to, what was it on Netflix? The Social Dilemma, that was talking about one of the statistics they give in looking at suicides in certain age demographics that could be shown that during the advent of Facebook changed a lot of those statistics.
Correlation, those are becoming even more obvious now as they're able to look back over the last, 15 years. 2007 is when it really came
out. I agree with you. And this is where one of those things, though, I don't think it has to be binary, right? Just because we've had the advent of technology doesn't mean, all right, well, it's turned bad now. We've created more anxiety than we've ever had. Therefore, snap back to where we once were, right? It's like my parents' argument. When I was a kid, we did it this way. Okay.
We made fun with just a stick.
Right. Yes.
But you know what? They did, because that's what they had.
Yeah.
So
But is there a middle ground? Yes, I think that there really is. And I think a lot of those, a component of what you just walked through is the human nature as well. In the absence of information, we get to create our own narrative. And most often the narrative we create is super negative.
Yeah.
This gets back to like the whole idea of Occam's razor and stuff, that the simplest answer is usually the correct answer, but that's not human nature. We gravitate towards this elaborate scheme that of what's actually going on. And oh no, my phone just died. That's why I didn't call you.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm going to
not that I hate you and that you scorn me. And then, you know, and
right. I'm super guilty of that, because like Kelly has her phone shut off in the car so that it can't get updates. And I know that. So like, if I send her a note, like, hey, what time are you going to be home? And I don't hear back, I'm like, well, she's in the car. And then I'm like, maybe she's going to hit a stop sign. How far away are you? And then I still don't hear back. And I'm like, just send me that note, right? It's that not knowing part that drives you nuts. And Dan, you are 100% right. And I'm surprised my son hasn't said this to me, because I'm super proud of him. And maybe I'd be even more proud if he turned it on me and said, I think you need to do this now, Dad. Going back X number four years ago, when we had the conversation with him about what anxiety is and what that's going to feel like. And you're going to get the cell phone, but we're going to take it away from you at night. And you're only going to have it during these hours of the day. And then when you get data, what this means. And in the first few months, he came to us and was like, that feeling that you said I'd have, and we were trying to explain it, but what it, he goes, I feel that. He goes, because all my friends are allowed to have their phones at night. When I put my phone down, I have felt like, oh, I wonder what they're talking about, or, oh, I'm missing out on this, right? There's that missing out part. So I'm going to give a shout out to a buddy of mine from high school, because at first I questioned it before I got into cybersecurity, but I was really proud of him for what he had put together. And his name's Ryan Beal. I went to school with him. But he lost his brother to suicide. And in the years following, he noticed the impact that Facebook had and social media had. And he decided to take a step away from Facebook and document the feelings that he had and what he went through on week one, week two, month one, month two, and then where he was at 6 months later. And he wrote this book, right? Leaving Facebook. I can't remember the exact name of the book. I can pull it up. But after that, he went on to create what's called Prepare You, and like prepare, and then just you, like Prepare University. And it's Prepare You Mental Health. And he's now working with different school districts here in Michigan. And it's to help educate children on the impacts of social media. So fast forwarding to this year, when Kelly came to me and was like, hey, you're going to be really impressed with your son. He's working on a project. He doesn't want to tell you about it, but the school gives him a project that you got to turn in at the end of the year. And he's doing his on social media and the impacts that social media and being connected have, because he sees it based on the time that we took it away, and we still do, and the impacts that the other kids have, right? And I'm like, wow, right? Like I was proud, one, as a parent, but then if Brody could turn this on me with the, when I've sent him a note, like, hey, what time are you going to be home? And then I'm pinging Kelly like 10 minutes later, like, hey, I didn't hear from him. She's like, well, he's at practice. I'm like, well, when's he going to let me know? Like, I want to get dinner going, right? Like, and there's that little freak out mode, right? It's like, Brian, it ends at this time. He'll be home afterwards. And here's the real kicker. The school is right across the street. So he's walking home, right? Like, and I look back at when I was a kid and was like, Mom, Dan, to your point, yeah, I'll be home at, you know, 6:30, right? Mom would be like, no, you got to be home at 6, right?
Be home,
like,
for dinner, or be home by sundown in the summer, you know?
Okay. And then she'd be like, where are you going? And I'd be like, you know, we're going to head over to Steve's house to play basketball. We might go to John's. And she'd be like, John's? I'm like, she's like, that's a little far. I wouldn't let my kid go to... John lived like 2.5 miles away, right? I think I crossed 3 major roads on bicycle. And back then, one of them didn't even have a, there was no sidewalk. I was just.
I mean, to pivot this back to the movie, and I'm going to pick on the boardroom. Like, you're starting to see some of this fear around cyber start to creep in there as well. with just this fear that takes people over on what could be going on, what's happening within an organization, what a cyber attack could do, that ends up you could spend, and you see this play out not just internally from a board perspective, but also between companies. And Dan loves to talk about this all the time in the surveys that go out. Do you have this? Do you have this? Do you have this? And just this overarching fear within the cyberspace. And I think a lot of this comes back to what we're talking about here. It's just good communication. That all we're doing is getting out in front of things. Hey, yep, going to be home at X time. Cool. And just be trusting of that to a certain extent. And
I'll come back in a few years, Eric, and see if that's how you're doing it when the kids get old enough. But it is hard. It's a conscious effort that you have to make. And so that's what I take away from it. Eric, what do you take away from the movie, and what would you likely change?
What am I going to change? I don't know if I would change anything personally. For me, I just looked at it as an interesting Hollywood view of our space, kind of infused with the changing dynamics within the social fabric. From that perspective, I just thought it was interesting. For me, I think it just continues to highlight, and now we're starting to see media around this, on as we continue to push forward on technology and everything, that our reliance on code, that it doesn't necessarily serve us as well as we think it's going to serve us in the long run. And I feel like there's a local automaker that found this out the hard way in deciding to write their own operating system.
That could never go wrong. And it certainly wouldn't stop sales of a particular SUV just a few weeks in because the system was shutting itself down.
Yeah,
But what would make it better is if we had AI build the code for us.
Oh, absolutely.
What could go wrong?
Yeah. Humans build AI, AI builds code. There's no room for error there.
Film at 11.
It did make me think, though, like when we build a new home, right? Like I had all these things that I wanted to put in the home, right? And it's like the whole redundancy things, like I was super big into all the different smart switches and everything else. And I still am. Like, I still love my Lutron cassette and the ability to control it from my phone and everything else. And if the Wi-Fi doesn't work, the lights still work. You can still turn it on, turn it off. Right. And when I was buying them, then I was going in blind, meaning it was like, oh, this one's cool. Right. There's no research done on my part. You know, this is the most expensive one at Home Depot. It must be the greatest. Right. Like now you can do a little bit of research on your own, but even then, like, I'm surprised, you know, when something new pops up on Amazon and it already has like 4,500 reviews to it. It's like, how did you get 4,500 reviews that fast? And I know they're trying to do a better job of quailing that and pulling that in. But I was just thinking in general, like, what things would I do different when building a home? And this isn't around really cyber, but this goes to the idea of how you fix things and replace things. So like having a central area for every gas line tie off, where I have a shutoff valve built into the wall, right? And where that's located. Same thing on the water side, right? So that it's not one main shutoff where that comes on in. I now have all the cold lines, all the hot lines going off for shutoff, right? I have a way to control it to wherever it goes in the house. Should I need to do something? Should this fail? There's a control here. And this just kind of goes back to the whole process failure mode. Like, if this fails, is there a way to shut it off? Or do I have to shut the entire house down? So I was looking at things differently from that standpoint. Like, you have one chance when you build something to put in a foundation and run all the piping in the concrete. After that, unless you start jackhammering things up, right, you're building off of that. And I think that would be one thing I do. And then the same thing, I think I need to take a deep look internally at myself from a patient standpoint. I don't know that Kelly's going to watch this episode, if she does. Because as you were talking, Dan, it gave me quite a bit of reflection on the idea that I could see myself in the impatience that I have in both when I send a note and want to reply back, people that have worked for me or work with me. And it's like, I know you have your phone on, I need this now. And do I really need it now? Did it make that big of a difference? Right. And then starting to take that reflection and taking a step back, I think would be a more calming presence to everybody around me.
Right.
So not to speak, not to say that I speak Brian, but I heard a few key elements in there. One, this is continuity planning, understanding how redundancies could exist. But the reason I wanted to bring this up was there are going to be pieces of that that go beyond, you know, when again in the movie, the plane hits the land, hits the thing, the water floods the house and breaks out everything. You know what? There's going to be the 100 years flood. You're not going to be able to prepare for the 100 years flood or afford to prepare for it. So putting in reasonable controls to get you through the most reasonable things, but accepting the fact that some of these are just not going to be mitigatable.
Right.
The other that I really like, and it reflects something I've been doing for a while, and I'm excited to see more people doing this. You know, the idea that instant response, things like read receipts. You know, when the LinkedIn thing goes, dude, he read your mail, but he didn't respond. Turn that off. Turn those things off on your iPhone, on everything. Nobody needs to know that you read it and didn't respond. Nobody needs to know that you're contemplating it. Maybe you're in bed at 2 in the morning and you pick up your phone. Yes, another bad habit. But you pick up your phone, you look at it, you go, yeah, I'll get to that in the morning. Guys, the sender sees that you read it and didn't reply immediately, and they flip out. You know, all of these things are leading. There's just a bunch of those kinds of things. I guess the third was design things to the tolerance of your customer. In this case, the home, the smart home. If Jen listens to this, she's going to get a treasure trove of ammo of things I won't say out loud in real life. But you know, you design that the switches work. And they work in a way that are good for the people in the house, not just for you, the propeller head. Again, ask me how I know this. All of these are things that you lead in, and then decide what the backups are. So anyhow, that was my synopsis of Brian's commentary.
Yeah, I was going to say, double clicking on something that you kind of drilled into, Dan, that I think is extremely important, specifically just tying it to the security space. I don't know how many times, and I'm sure you've heard this too, Dan, is how do you sleep at night? Just fine, right? Because you think about, you're talking about the 100-year flood, all of these different risks. There is so much that we can't control for. So what do? We put ourselves in a position to be able to respond to it. It goes back to things are going to happen that we can't foresee. We just put ourselves in a defensible position that we can respond to it. But thinking too, one of the other things that did highlight for me, and this is completely non-technical at all, that if you think about it, Sandra Bullock was not a likable character for the first good portion
Julia
of
Roberts.
or Julia Roberts, sorry.
Sandra Bullock was in that other movie that only had four people in it, The Gravity.
Yeah, I'm getting them all confused. But yes, so Julia Roberts. But
Yeah,
if you think
unlikable.
about it,
Very unlikable.
the inflection point was when they're in towards the end in the shed, and all of a sudden the switch got flipped to what are our differences to what actually makes us the same. And if you think about that from a societal view, I think we're missing that oftentimes. And this is where I'll take a shot at social media. I think it plays on these differences that everything's got to have a label, label tied to it. But if you get down to our base level, so much, there's so much in common between those around us, and we're missing it because we're fixated on those little nuanced differences that holistically actually make us better because it's different viewpoints on many topics that are not binary. It depends.
And all of and it's a great time to bring that up because I don't know about you, but I'm not looking forward to the next 10 months and 5 days here in the US because of exactly that, because it all plays on pulling you into labels, pulling people, you know, why you are different from other people. And that's not, yeah, you know, that I think we've got plenty of that, and it's time to find out how we're the same. Well, guys, we are out of time. This is a great discussion about a great movie. If you haven't seen it, or if you haven't figured out yet, we're talking about a movie, Leave the World Behind. It's currently on streaming on Netflix, so you do have to stream it. I don't think you can buy it on DVD. I don't have it in my DVD collection, but you can stream it on Netflix, and I encourage you to do so. It was a good movie. Although I think Eric or Brian, when you mentioned this in our last episode, in our last recording, you led me to believe that it was going to be more like Swordfish, in which I would cringe at the bad security lingo used inappropriately, and movie OS that shows Pac-Man eating the bad guys in a graphical fashion, which is what the world thinks security is. But it was not. It was a much more realistic and much more down to earth approach to the end of the world. No, it is do give it a look. And thank you, thanks Eric, and thanks Brian for another great security debate, and thanks to you, the listener. We absolutely treasure the info that that you share with us, the feedback you give us, and the fact that you are that you're enjoying the content that we have that we create. We're excited to announce that that the Great Security Debate has become part of the Distilling Security Network. It's going to be a network of shows, live events, podcasts, videos, and other presentations, all focused around security, privacy, and compliance. We've got a new website that's up, distillingsecurity.com. We have shows, all of our shows, Great Security Debate shows, along with some others that are joining the network, with plans for brand new shows throughout the year and other ways that you can contribute. If you are interested in helping us out, one of the things we want to do to grow this is we're looking for your help. We're looking for your support. We've set up a page on a system called Ko-fi, Ko-fi. I think I'm pronouncing that right. Ko-fi/distillingsecurity. If you'd like to help us out with a financial support, can be a one-time thing, can be a recurring thing. We would love to have that happen. It's going to help us work with editors to make more shows come out, help us get some of the tech to keep Brian in his other studio from fading into the background. Although I don't know that we'll use it to pay for a shave for Brian's crazy beard. But all of these things are things we have on the horizon, and we're looking for other ways to support and interact with you, our listeners, throughout the year. So take a look, visit distillingsecurity.com, and you can reach us. An email you send to securitydebate@distillingsecurity.com will come to the three of us. And we want to hear what you think. We want to hear what you think of Distilling Security, of the Great Security Debate, ideas you have for future episodes, and more. You can find us on Mastodon at Distilling Security and at Security Debate. You can find us on LinkedIn, the Great Security Debate. We have a page. If you become a subscriber, you'll get notified every time we have an episode. We have a newsletter that's on the main page of Distilling Security. If you go to distillingsecurity.com, fill out your name, your first name, and your email address, we'll notify you when new episodes come out of these shows, of Great Security Debate, of Mentor Corps, and of all of our future shows, as well as news and information about what's happening on the network. Thanks again for being part of all this. We're really excited to start 2024 off with this new news, and we're grateful to have you as part of the family. Thanks again, and we look forward to seeing you again on the next Great Security Debate.